Part 2, 1961. Chapter 10, An Assassination Capability. On the morning of February 23, 1961, in the residential Miramar district of Havana, Che Guevara left his home on 17th Street and walked with his bodyguards down the pretty, tree-lined street headed to his car. As he climbed in the driver's seat, four or five assassins emerged from where they'd been hiding in the bushes and opened fire. A violent gun battle left one of Che's neighbors, a man identified as Mr. Salinas, dead on the grass. As Che sped away, his bodyguards continued firing. Inside the house, Che's wife, Alida, heard the intense gunfire. She grabbed their three-month-old daughter, Aladita, and with their nanny, rushed to hide under the stairwell. In Havana, there was a news blackout on the attempted assassination. Alida Guevara kept her story secret for 30 years, sharing it with Che's biographer, John Lee Anderson, after she left Cuba for Spain to live in exile. Because Cuba is a police state, very little unflattering news ever leaves the island. That such an important leader as Che Guevara would be vulnerable to assassination was not a message the Castro regime wanted to convey. Instead, a semi-official cover story emerged, purporting that the dead man, Mr. Salinas, had been having an affair and that the killing was an illicit romance gone awry. In a country where possession of an illegal firearm was a capital offense, the cover story seems implausible. Was the CIA involved? Or were the assassins really anti-Castro Cubans acting on their own? Further news was repressed, not surprising, given Che Guevara's views of the press. "Newspapers are instruments of the oligarchy," he told the Cuban people. "We must eliminate all newspapers. We cannot make a revolution with free press." As of 2019, the mystery remains unsolved. But in response to the assassination attempt against him, Che Guevara is said to have kept a grenade in the cigar box he often carried. After three failed attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro, in late January or early February 1961, Felix Rodriguez was reassigned to the CIA's Brigade 2506. He was emplaced on a five-man, direct-action, paramilitary team called a Gray Team. The Gray Teams would be infiltrated into Cuba in advance of an assault by Brigade 2506 at Bahia de Cojinos, the Bay of Pigs. Assassination plans aside, the CIA was now moving forward with a covert action amphibious invasion followed by a coup d'etat. The CIA was relying on its Gray Teams to locate, train, and equip pockets of previously identified resistance fighters, similar to what the OSS Jedburghs had done shortly after Allied forces stormed the beaches at Normandy. But in France, 93 Jedburgh teams had been airdropped in behind enemy lines. In Cuba, there were just 7 teams, each made up of 5 men. "It was high risk," Rodriguez remembers. 35 of us went to Cuba, only 15 survived. On February 28, 1961, Rodriguez and the members of his Gray Team left an isolated beach in Key West, bound for Cuba. This time, instead of a yacht, they rowed in a 25-foot Zodiac boat, filled to the gunwales with weapons and explosives. 4.5 hours later, the team made a stealth beach landing at Arcos de Canazi, 40 miles east of Havana. It was Rodriguez's first time back in Cuba since he was a schoolboy. "We had our weapons and backpacks, but we also had 2 tons of equipment, explosives, grenades, machine guns, ammunition, and communications equipment." To be caught likely meant summary execution. Rodriguez and his Gray Team members were met on the beach by anti-Castro partisans. local farmers and sugar mill workers who were members of a group called Movimiento de Recuperación Revolucionaria, MRR, a pro-U.S. resistance movement. The MRR had already been partially armed. CIA Air Branch pilots had managed to covertly airdrop bundles of World War II-era M3 submachine guns and .45-caliber pistols. In addition to the CIA's ground branch, there is Air Branch, which is the aviation wing of the Special Activities Division, and Maritime Branch for amphibious operations. There's also a political action arm, which interfaces with all three branches. From the beachhead at Arcos de Canasi, Felix Rodriguez was driven to Camagüey, where he was met with the head of the Cuban resistance, a young man who went by the code name Francisco. Seeing him on the street, you'd mistake him for a student, recalls Rodriguez. Francisco was an eloquent, soft-spoken engineering student. He naturally inspired people, Rodriguez said. The popularity of Francisco's movement made him the number one target of Castro's intelligence services, and meeting with him was a tense affair. Over the next few weeks, Felix Rodriguez moved from safe house to safe house around Havana, meeting individually with leaders of the underground. In mid-March, he was called back to Miami to resupply. Then he was told that he'd be reinserted again soon. The invasion would be happening any day now. Finally, word came. I was driven to the Keys by a lanky Texan who went by the codename Sherman, Rodriguez recalls. He presented me with something special to take to Cuba, a mini flamethrower. It fit very comfortably in one hand, yet it threw a 15-foot-yard-wide column of white phosphorus flame. The Texan told Rodriguez that the weapon was highly classified, but he wanted me to have it anyway. This time, he was inserted near Morón on the central coast. There, he was met by another member of the underground and driven to Havana in an old Buick, the flamethrower hidden underneath the dashboard. Rodriguez was dropped off at a safe house in El Vedado and told to lay low and await orders. In its Bay of Pigs invasion planning, the CIA pulled yet again from its own history, as we have seen. Modeling the invasion and coup on the Guatemala operation was ironic, given that those operations had radicalized Che Guevara. But Cuba in 1961 was a very different environment in which to operate than Guatemala had been in 1954. President Arbenz commanded an army of 10,000 men. Fidel Castro allegedly had 1 million soldiers on call. Arbenz, a socialist, did not run Guatemala as a military dictatorship. Castro controlled the people of Cuba with absolute power, using Soviet tactics of repression and fear. Most significant of all, Arbenz did not have a direct line to the Kremlin the way Castro did. In hindsight, the CIA's disastrous covert action Bay of Pigs operation was born of wishful thinking. As with all military dictatorships, spies in Cuba were ubiquitous. For the CIA, the threat of a double agent was a constant source of concern. Unknown to the agency, Castro had managed to infiltrate its ranks long before the invasion was given the green light. In Miami, the CIA had recruited Benigno Perez Vivancos, a former lieutenant in Castro's army, thinking he was an anti-Castro emigre. Vivancos stood out as brave and reliable and became the 78th fighting-age male recruited for Brigade 2506. In fact, he was a Castro loyalist sent by Havana to spy. The actions of this double agent proved deadly. On the night of April 1, 1961, not long after Felix Rodriguez arrived in Havana with his mini flamethrower, Castro's G2 intelligence conducted a raid on a house outside Havana and captured Francisco, whose real name was Rogelio González Corso. Tried and found guilty, he was immediately executed. Based on information provided by Vivancos, Castro's government rounded up thousands of people it identified as members of the resistance. Castro herded them into theaters, stadiums, and military bases to squelch the possibility of a spontaneous uprising to overthrow his regime, says a CIA Inspector General report. Unaware of the compromise, Rodriguez waited for word of the invasion. On April 13th, at CIA headquarters, Brigade 2506 was given the green light to set sail from Guatemala. On the morning of April 15th, 8 B-26 bombers supplied by the CIA and flown by Cuban emigre pilots attacked military airfields in Cuba in the first move of the covert operation. In response, Castro played an ingenious and unforeseen political card. He ordered his foreign minister, Raúl Roa, to call the United Nations Political and Security Committee in New York City and demand that an emergency session be held. The request was honored, the session attended by the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson. Cuba's foreign minister rightly decried the United States for having attacked a sovereign nation unprovoked. This was bad news for President Kennedy, whose number one priority was hiding the hand of the U.S. government, lamented an anonymous CIA staff historian in an agency report kept classified for decades. Lying to the UN had serious consequences, and a second airstrike would put the United States in an awkward position internationally. The result meant disaster for Brigade 2506. President Kennedy's political considerations trumped the military importance of a D-Day airstrike. Without a second strike, the amphibious assault had no chance for success. And the element of surprise was no longer there. Shortly before dawn the following morning, with Brigade 2506 just hours away from landing at the Bay of Pigs, President Kennedy canceled the second round of airstrikes. Pilots who'd been sitting on the runway awaiting orders for takeoff were told to stand down. As the sun rose on the morning of April 17th, 1,311 members of Brigade 2506 made an amphibious landing. But instead of accomplishing a stealth infiltration, the CIA's paramilitary army of Cuban exiles were met on shore by Castro's military, whose forces far outnumbered and outgunned them. In Havana, Felix Rodriguez learned about the Bay of Pigs invasion while listening to the radio. All the Cuban radio stations were broadcasting the same emergency network, he remembers, saying the same thing, that the Americans had tried to launch a coup d'etat and had failed. Peering out the window, Rodriguez watched in horror as a sea of military vehicles moved through the streets, each one overflowing with Castro's soldiers. On Cuban state TV, news footage showed members of Brigade 2506 as they were captured on the beach and marched off into the woods, their fates unknown. Four members of Felix Rodriguez's gray team were picked up and arrested. Rodriguez fled the safe house and made a run for the Venezuelan embassy. He was aware of a treaty that allowed political refugees safe passage out of Cuba. After weeks in hiding inside the embassy, he was finally loaded onto a bus of refugees and driven to the airport. In a bitter twist of fate, the bus drove first through Miramar, passing Che Guevara's home on 17th Street, where, 2 months earlier, the assassination attempt against him had failed. It continued on past Uncle Toto's once grand home on 5th Avenue and 28th Street, where Felix had enjoyed so many happy childhood memories. It had been turned over to the state, says Rodriguez. Like all private property, it would be divided up among the people. Later, I would learn 5 Soviet families were living there, he recalls. The Bay of Pigs was an extraordinary political embarrassment for President Kennedy. In the Dominican Republic, Consul General Henry Dearborn, the U.S. State Department's charge d'affaires at the embassy in Santo Domingo, was woken up in the middle of the night and told to cancel the CIA's plan to assassinate Trujillo. I recall a frantic message from the State Department, I guess signed off on by President Kennedy, Dearborn remembered in 1991. It was saying, in effect, look, we have all this trouble with Castro. We don't want any more trouble in the Caribbean. Tell those people to knock it off, meaning the assassination plot. Dearborn followed orders, he says. I communicated to the opposition people that Washington was very much against any attempt at assassination. The answer I got back from them was, just tell Washington it is none of their business. This is our business. We have planned it, and we are going to do it, and there is nothing you can do about it. I relayed this to Washington, said Dearborn. The plan to assassinate Trujillo went ahead despite Washington's 11th-hour attempts to call it off. On the night of May 30, 1961, Trujillo was seated in the back seat of his chauffeur-driven 1957 Chevrolet Bel Air, traveling down a country road outside the capital when he was ambushed by a group of 7 assassins brandishing weapons provided to the rebel group by the CIA. We started shooting, recalled one of the killers, General Antonio Imbert, in an interview with the BBC in 2011. President Trujillo and his chauffeur were both armed and they began shooting back. Trujillo managed to get out of the car. Trujillo was wounded, but he was still walking, so I shot him again and killed him, said General Imbert. We put him in our car and took him away. The assassins drove the dictator's dead body to a safe house belonging to the partisans, where it was later discovered by state police. Dearborn remembered hearing the news. He was out in the suburbs at a country club. The Chinese ambassador was giving some kind of a money-raising thing for charity to which I went. After the event ended, Dearborn and a colleague left together in a State Department car. We started back around 11 p.m. and ran into a roadblock along the Ocean Highway. The state police were stopping cars and conducting searches. They looked in trunks, pulled up rugs, etc. I had a CIA fellow in the car. Along about January, the CIA had sent a couple of people into the consulate, and I said, Bob, this is it. I am sure this is it. The state police wouldn't let the men continue down that road. When we finally got to the embassy, where I had been living for about a year, the telephone rang, and one of my main contacts of the opposition said, it is over. He is dead. I knew immediately what happened, and went down to the office and sent off a message to Washington. For the CIA, the assassination of President Trujillo had been an inadvertent success. The killers got away, although they were soon to be betrayed by co-conspirator General José Román. Hundreds of people suspected of being complicit in Trujillo's assassination were rounded up, detained and tortured in a move that echoed what happened in Czechoslovakia after Reinhard Heydrich's assassination by the British Special Operations Executive. 6 of the 7 Trujillo assassins were caught and executed. Only General Antonio Imbert got away. Decades later, the consensus in the Dominican Republic is that killing Trujillo was a heroic act, a textbook example of tyrannicide, the justified killing of a tyrant. We Dominicans react very negatively when the people who killed Trujillo are called assassins, says Bernardo Vega, a former ambassador to the United States. Killing the cruelest dictator in the Americas, says Vega, was a good thing to do. The week after General Trujillo was buried, the U.S. State Department's Henry Dearborn was notified of a plan for his assassination. Dearborn was ordered to pack up his things, drive to the airport, and leave at once. He hurried to his office and loaded all the secret files into a burn barrel to destroy. Now, in good conscience, he said, he could leave. In a State Department oral history, he relayed a funny incident that drew to a close his 3 years as America's top diplomat in the Dominican Republic. I had my shirt, tie, shoes, and socks on, but couldn't find my pants, he remembered. I said to my administrative assistant, an officer's wife, "Where are my pants?" She said, "Oh my God, I packed them." She had to go back down to the car outside and unpack my pants so that I could leave the country with dignity. Upon landing in the United States, Dearborn was called to Washington, D.C., to participate in a briefing of the President of the United States. John F. Kennedy himself, intensely interested in covert action, had asked to be briefed on the Trujillo assassination by those involved. In declassified Senate testimony, Dearborn later recalled, "One enlightening part of the discussion occurred when I interrupted Kennedy and said, 'I think that—'" The president interrupted me and said, "We already know what you think." In his oral history, Dearborn made clear what President Kennedy's statement meant to him. "That showed clearly enough that he had been reading my cables," Dearborn said. Dearborn's remembrance is notable, given an official Department of Justice summation with respect to Trujillo's assassination. In giving testimony for the Attorney General's official report, that would be Attorney General Robert Kennedy, chairman of the special group, the CIA officials who were interviewed stated that they had no active part but had a faint connection with the groups that in fact did assassinate the president. Henry Dearborn knew otherwise. When the meeting with the president broke up, he shook hands with me and said, "You did a good job down there." Dearborn stood by his actions and those taken by the president's special group advisors, the State Department, and the CIA. "It is my firmly held view that those who killed Trujillo and those who backed them up would have acted if there had never been a CIA. They were only waiting for a favorable domestic and international atmosphere to give them the required courage," Dearborn stated on the record in 1991. He died in 2013 at the age of 100. Shortly after Rafael Trujillo was assassinated, President Kennedy's special group formalized assassination as a foreign policy tool, a program it called Executive Action Capability, but which Congress later determined as an assassination capability. Declassified testimony given to Senate investigators by CIA Deputy Director of Plans, Richard Bissell, suggests that the person who authorized the assassination capability was President Kennedy. The special group, Augmented, had received its orders from National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy and Deputy National Security Advisor Walt Rostow, Bissell told Senate investigators behind closed doors. But these presidential advisors would not have given such encouragement unless they were confident that it would meet with the president's approval. Moving forward under the Kennedy administration, assassination operations acquired new euphemisms, including direct positive action, neutralization operations, an accident plot, and the last resort. Under the impossibly unsubtle cryptonym ZR Rifle, the CIA's Executive Action Office was staffed with an array of people from senior managers to case officers, even a principal agent with the primary task of spotting agent candidates, operatives willing to carry out and to conceal the executive action capability. The CIA's Technical Services Division provided covert action operators with whatever items they might need, from disguises to weapons to poisons. The Directorate of Support handled financial and administrative matters. The Office of Security made sure overseas clandestine facilities remained secure. Assassination was now an acceptable course of action, Congress learned, made possible through the establishment of plausible deniability. The chairman of the special group was usually responsible for determining which projects required presidential consideration and from keeping him abreast of developments. According to Bissell, after President Kennedy appointed his brother chairman of the special group augmented, the construct became almost impenetrable. In this way, a system of plausible denial was fortified, said Bissell, a series of obfuscations that served as circuit breakers for presidents, preventing the Oval Office from being dragged into scandal should a hidden hand operation be revealed. The president's assassination capability was intended to serve as a means of bringing order to the increasingly volatile situations unfolding in Cuba, Laos, and Vietnam. Instead, it created mayhem, chaos, and collapse. But the real question, the riddle wrapped inside a mystery, inside an enigma, was and remains: by allowing the use of assassination as a hidden hand foreign policy tool, did President Kennedy become an easier target to assassinate? Chapter 11. JFK, KIA. President John F. Kennedy was outraged with the CIA over the failure at the Bay of Pigs, which stained his first 100 days as president. He'd campaigned on an anti-communist plank, singling out Cuba as a hostile and militant communist satellite, receiving guidance, support, and arms from Moscow and Peking. To have failed so publicly, so early in his presidency, infuriated him. Adding insult to injury, Che Guevara personally expressed his gratitude to the young president for the spectacular defeat, using White House emissary Richard Goodwin to relay his sarcastic message. Guevara said he wanted to thank us very much for the invasion, Goodwin told the president, that it had been a great political victory for them, enabled them to consolidate and transform Cuba from an aggrieved little country to an equal. In response, President Kennedy made a move so shocking it upended covert action operations in a way not seen since the creation of Title 50 and National Security Council Directive 10-2, NSC 10-2. He gutted the existing paramilitary authority at the CIA, making any large paramilitary operation that was wholly or partially covert now the primary responsibility of the Defense Department, with CIA in a supporting role. The fiasco at the Bay of Pigs changed everything, says CIA staff historian John L. Helgerson. CIA Director Alan Dulles asked to meet with the president, who refused. The president's mind was made up. There is no point in the DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, discussing the matter directly with the president, as that would be counterproductive, Presidential Advisor General Chester Clifton curtly informed the CIA. For the first time since 1947, the Pentagon was now in charge of the president's guerrilla warfare corps. I can't overemphasize the shock, not simply the words, that procedure caused in Washington, to the Secretary of State, to the Secretary of Defense, and particularly to the Director of Central Intelligence, said Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, Chief of Special Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Kennedy. Historians have glossed over that or don't know about it, Prouty said in 1989. Kennedy lost the battle for a democratic Cuba in a most humiliating and public way. Now he was unwilling to experience a loss in Vietnam. It wasn't that the new president opposed Hidden Hand paramilitary operations. He opposed the CIA's handling of them. In a series of meetings with his national security advisors, he ordered covert action operations to be accelerated in Vietnam, only now they would be led by U.S. Army Special Forces. This maverick move would have far-reaching consequences, not just in Vietnam, but around the world, and not just in 1961, but for decades to come. By their very definition, paramilitary operations exist outside formal military operations. Para means distinct from. To have the Defense Department now engaging in non-official military operations inside a foreign country during peacetime was a radical move into uncharted territory. Immediately after the Bay of Pigs, President Kennedy asked top advisor General Maxwell Taylor to review all U.S. paramilitary capabilities and advise on next steps. Taylor submitted a report recommending that the president broaden the scope of classified covert operations in Vietnam. Kennedy authorized 3 top-secret national security action memorandums in succession, significantly widening a war that technically did not exist. To oversee operations in theater, the Joint Chiefs of Staff created a new office inside the Pentagon called the Special Assistant for Counterinsurgency and Special Activities, SACSA, to be run by a military general and his staff. SACSA would now function as the CIA's Office of Policy Coordination had during Korea. The man chosen to run SACSA was a Marine Corps general named Victor Brute Krulak. A legend among his men, Brute Krulak was famous at the Pentagon for the risky nighttime amphibious raids he'd led on islands across the Pacific during World War II. On one of these raids, he was leading 30 commandos on an ambush when their vessel hit a reef and began to sink. Facing certain death, they were rescued by a torpedo boat crew commanded by a young lieutenant colonel named John F. Kennedy. The president and the general had history, and now Krulak was entrusted with a highly classified, highly unorthodox new job at the Department of Defense to oversee quasi-military operations inside a sovereign nation against a belligerent force of guerrilla fighters without a formal declaration of war. One of SACSA's first questions was what to do about Laos. President Eisenhower left John F. Kennedy with a muddled, complicated, and intractable situation in Laos. Laos was a victim of geography, Kennedy's special group advisors told him, hardly a nation except in the legal sense. But to lose Laos would be the beginning of the loss of most of the Far East, Eisenhower forewarned. In an effort to contain communist insurgency within Vietnam's borders, President Kennedy decided to pursue diplomacy in Laos. He canceled Operation White Star and instructed his advisors to negotiate a neutralization treaty. In July 1962, the governments of the United States, the Soviet Union, North Vietnam, and numerous other nations signed the Declaration on the Neutrality of Laos, agreeing to leave Laos alone. They all did, says scholar Richard Schultz, except for the NVA, the Army of North Vietnam. Insurgents do not honor borders or treaties. This reality continues to plague the Defense Department in 2019. The Laos Neutralization Treaty of 1962 was a colossal deception and a huge strategic win for North Vietnam. By the time the treaty was signed, Hanoi had already spent 3 long years building a clandestine transportation route and logistical system from Hanoi through Laos and into the south. Eventually, it would also include trails through Cambodia. This was the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the secret supply route Hanoi used to move fighters and weapons into territory it sought to control in the south. While the United States felt bound by honor to adhere to the neutrality declaration, Hanoi escalated its prohibited use of the trail. This gave the communists extraordinary momentum and new advantage at a critical time in their revolution. Blind to the realities of the trail, the month after the Laos Treaty was signed, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara called a meeting in Honolulu, Hawaii, bringing together the Defense Department, the Pacific Command, the CIA, and the State Department. McNamara presented Operation Switchback, a robust, covert action program designed to inflict increasing punishment upon North Vietnam. One of the first orders of business was to create a new guerrilla warfare corps for the president to carry out the punishment promised by the Secretary of Defense. Now in a subordinate role, the CIA merged its existing paramilitary program, the Civilian Irregular Defense Group, CIDG, into the Defense Department's Military Assistance Command, Vietnam, MACV. Billy Waugh was an early member of the group and became one of the first Green Berets sent to Vietnam in this capacity. Waugh's group trained President Diem's soldiers in paramilitary tactics, in everything from sabotage and assassination to evade and escape, Waugh recalls. The goal of the CIDG program was to create direct action strike force units made up of South Vietnamese peasants from indigenous hill tribes led by U.S. Army Green Berets and CIA advisors. This was a grander, more ambitious version of what the OSS Special Operations Groups, including the Jedburghs, had accomplished during World War II. Waugh and his fellow trainers were to arm the rebels and teach them how to sabotage, subvert, and assassinate the communist infiltrators coming down from the north. The effort was astonishing. Unlike the CIA, whose access to military resources had been limited, SACSA had the Defense Department to call upon, with its resupply capacity that seemed to know no bounds. Through a CIDG support office on Okinawa, warfighting supplies were airdropped into Vietnam by the ton. Each month, an average of 740 tons of weapons and supplies were delivered to Special Forces units set up in remote villages across South Vietnam. By the end of 1962, there were over 33,300 South Vietnamese peasants being paid by the Defense Department to participate in the CIDG program. Assigned American military-style titles, the participants were broken down by number: 6,000 Direct Action Strike Force troops, 19,000 Village Defender Militia, 2,700 Mountain Scouts, 5,300 Popular Forces troops, and 300 Border Surveillance Guards. 12 months later, the number skyrocketed again. There were now more than 87,000 peasants on U.S. taxpayer payroll. But the program was grossly ineffective. When the NVA and Viet Cong attacked a village, the strike force just ran away. This is not to say that they were afraid, wrote Colonel Francis J. Kelly, an unconventional warfare expert for the Pentagon and the man who later commanded all special forces in Vietnam. Most had seen a great deal of fighting. They were just not interested in or even remotely enthusiastic about the program. From the point of view of the Vietnam Special Forces and the government, the CIDG program was an American project. For Ngo Dinh Diem, the American-supported president of South Vietnam, what was happening in remote areas of the country meant very little. His own situation in Saigon had become dire. The Americans were beginning to lose faith in his leadership, and his military generals were plotting to overthrow him. The people of South Vietnam hated him. He persecuted Buddhists and liberal Democrats in equal measure, arresting monks and nightclub owners, banning boxing matches and beauty pageants. He could barely control the unrest that was building in the cities in Saigon and Hue. When people gathered to protest, Diem dispatched military police to beat them into submission. By the spring of 1963, Diem's presidency was on the brink of collapse. The Kennedy White House now viewed the colonialist in the white three-piece suit as a losing horse. The only person in South Vietnam more hated than President Diem was his brother, Ngo Dinh Nguyen, chief of the secret police and commander of Army Special Forces. In a last-ditch effort to salvage Diem's presidency, the White House wondered if perhaps the real problem wasn't Nguyen. Through State Department channels, President Diem was told to consider getting rid of his brother. Word came back, never. The tipping point came in June 1963. When in protest of Diem's policies, a Buddhist monk named Thich Quang Duc set himself on fire in the middle of a busy Saigon street. The self-immolation was photographed and the image of a human being on fire was reprinted in newspapers around the world. While the international community was shocked by the horror and tragedy of the monk's self-sacrifice, the Diem regime publicly mocked him. This led to what would become known as the Buddhist uprisings. In August 1963, after Diem declared martial law, the White House decided that it would no longer support President Diem. The CIA dispatched Lieutenant Colonel Lucien Conin to gather intelligence. Conin served the CIA as the Saigon station liaison between Henry Cabot Lodge, then serving as U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, and South Vietnam's top military generals, a job Conin did well owing to a unique history with several of Diem's generals. Back in 1945, the French-speaking Conin served as a member of the OSS DEER team, the American group that armed and trained Ho Chi Minh, General Giap, and several hundred of their Viet Minh guerrilla fighters. During that time period, Conin befriended many young Vietnamese officers, some of whom now served as generals under President Diem. In an effort to determine what was happening at the palace, Conin met with several of Diem's generals, using a dentist's office for these clandestine meetings. Conin learned that the generals were planning to overthrow President Diem. The leader of the insurrection was General Duong Van Minh, Big Minh as he was known. Conin relayed this information to the president and his advisors. In turn, Conin was told to tell the generals that the White House supported this idea. "We will not attempt to thwart this action," President Kennedy told Conin, trying to sound officially uninvolved. On the morning of November 1, 1963, Lucien Conin awoke, changed into his military uniform, and prepared himself for the coup d'etat that was about to begin. He tucked an ivory-handled .375 Magnum revolver into his waist and filled a bag meant for big men with 3 million Vietnamese piastres, roughly $40,000 in cash. Years later, Senate investigators asked Conein if he knew that the generals he was giving this money to planned on killing President Diem. The majority of the officers desired President Diem to have an honorable retirement, Conein swore. Regarding his brother and other powerful figures in the regime, the attitude was that their deaths would be welcomed. With green berets guarding his family, Conein picked up a secure telephone given to him by big men and called the CIA with a secret code, 99999. The coup d'etat against President Diem was about to begin. Conein kissed his wife and children goodbye, climbed into an army jeep waiting in the driveway, and headed off to headquarters near the airport. At 1:30 p.m., scores of big men loyalists burst into army offices, police headquarters, and radio stations around Saigon, holding people at gunpoint and informing them that if they resisted, they'd be shot. Military trucks loaded with artillery surrounded the palace. President Diem and his brother slipped out the back and disappeared. Diem's loyal bodyguards had no idea that their president had fled, and dozens of these men died defending the palace and Diem's honor. By 3 a.m., the palace was overrun, and soon looters were running through the streets with President Diem's possessions, gilded furniture, fine whiskey, American adventure magazines. At 6 a.m., President Diem reached out to big men from inside the Catholic Church in Colón, where he and his brother were hiding. Diem offered to surrender, provided he was given the full honors due a departing president. When big men refused, Diem settled for unconditional surrender and gave up his location at the church. Big men dispatched an American-made M113 armored personnel carrier and four jeeps filled with soldiers to retrieve the deposed president and his brother. On the drive back to the palace, alongside a train crossing, Diem and Nu were executed, shot with automatic weapons inside the armored vehicle. Their bullet-riddled bodies were photographed and then buried in an unmarked grave adjacent to the Saigon residence of U.S. Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge. For all the euphemism and convoluted language behind and around President Kennedy's assassination program, there was absolutely nothing vague or indirect about the assassination that took place just 3 weeks later on November 22, 1963, in Dallas, Texas. From the perspective of U.S. Secret Service agent Clinton J. Hill, killing a leader is a visceral and sickening reality. Clint Hill, age 32, had been on the presidential protective detail since the Eisenhower administration, when he guarded the president's mother-in-law, Elvira Matilda Carlson Dowd. During the Kennedy White House, he served as the special agent in charge of Jacqueline Kennedy, overseeing her safety at all times. On this day in Dallas, the president had made a protocol change. He didn't want Secret Service agents, including Clint Hill, to be standing on the running boards of the open-topped presidential limousine. Instead, Hill was now riding in a car directly behind the president and Mrs. Kennedy. He had weapons at the ready, a pistol at his waist, an AR-15 automatic rifle on the seat beside him, and a shotgun in the compartment near the jump seats. When the first shot rang out, Clint Hill leapt out of the vehicle he was traveling in and ran to the president's limousine, using the rear running board to climb onto the trunk area and reach for Mrs. Kennedy, who was reaching out to him. He watched as the president grabbed his throat and lurched forward. A second shot rang out, blasting off a portion of the president's head. As Clint Hill covered Mrs. Kennedy with his body, he observed the president. The right rear portion of his head was missing. It was lying in the rear seat of the car. His brain was exposed. There was blood and bits of brain all over the entire rear portion of the car, Hill told the Warren Commission. As the limousine raced to the hospital, a sobbing Mrs. Kennedy tried to make sense of the carnage. "My God, they shot his head off," she told Clint Hill. Then, to her dead husband, she implored, sobbing, "Jack, Jack, what have they done to you?" At the hospital, doctors determined that a piece of the president's skull was missing. "The next day, we found the missing portion of the president's head," Clint Hill told investigators. "It was found in the street." Years later, in an interview for the New York Times, former CIA director Richard Helms made a provocative statement. Helms began his intelligence career with the OSS in 1942 and retired in 1973, having served Presidents Johnson and Nixon as director of Central Intelligence. Under the Kennedy administration, he served as CIA Deputy Director of Plans, which put him in charge of the president's executive action capability. In this capacity, Helms oversaw the Kennedy administration's assassination program, including more than 20 now declassified plots to kill Fidel Castro with an exploding cigar, a contaminated diving suit, poison botulism toxin pills, and other schemes, all of which failed. "If you kill someone else's leaders," Helms told David Frost on national television in 1978, "why shouldn't they kill yours?" Within a year and a half, the covert war became an overt war. The United States increased its military forces in South Vietnam and in March began bombing Hanoi in Operation Rolling Thunder. The governments of Russia and China increased support to Hanoi, providing men, weapons, and guerrilla warfare expertise to the communists. In Washington, D.C., in an effort to define U.S. Defense Department goals inside Vietnam, John McNaughton, Assistant Secretary of the Department, used a percentage calculus in a memo for National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy. 70% to avoid a humiliating U.S. defeat, 20% to keep SVN, South Vietnam, territory from Chinese hands, 10% to permit the people of SVN to enjoy a better, freer way of life. In South Vietnam, joint CIA Defense Department hit-and-run ambush operations by the Civilian Irregular Defense Group continued full bore, unleashing bloodshed and chaos on an increasingly divided civilian population while achieving little of the Pentagon's percentage-based goals. Now it was dawn on June 17, 1965, and Billy Waugh was leading a 90-man CIDG team on an ambush against an enemy camp inside a village called Bong Son. The camp, believed to house 200 to 300 communist fighters, was located in South Vietnam, but was under the control of communist forces. Of 90 CIDG men, one was CIA, three were Green Berets, and 86 were indigenous villagers. Their mission was to sneak up on the enemy soldiers while they were sleeping, kill as many of them as possible, and get out without loss. Surprise, kill, vanish. The CIDG men had left their Special Forces A-team camp at 1:30 that morning. Waugh was the point man, now leading the team silently on a narrow trail that snaked along the An Lao River. Just 17 kilometers inland from the coast, the terrain was dense jungle. It was hot and humid, already 85 degrees. After roughly an hour of walking, the team came upon an NVA soldier who was supposed to be keeping guard but had fallen asleep. Waugh instructed one of the Indige to cut the man's throat. Examining the dead soldier's possessions, remembers Waugh, we noted the modern gear he carried, a shiny Chinese pistol, a Russian AK-47, brand new jungle boots, and an excellent radio. Inside the soldier's medicine kit was an array of supplies almost identical to what Special Forces medics carried, and Waugh remembers noting the odd symmetry involved. The kill or be killed rule of unconventional warfare. We took his gear and continued on. The three other Americans on the team were Captain Paris D. Davis, the highest-ranking non-commissioned officer in the group, Sergeant Robert D. Brown, a medic, and Staff Sergeant Davis Morgan, the team's liaison to the CIA. Captain Paris Davis, a blue-eyed black man from Washington, D.C., had never been in combat before, says Waugh, and the same went for Sergeant Robert Brown, an all-American kid from Montana who would soon be dead with a bullet in his head. The CIA operator David Morgan, like Waugh, battle-tested and sharp-witted, unafraid of fierce combat or hard work, had already served multiple tours in Vietnam. Each of the Special Forces soldiers wore green battle fatigues and carried an M16 rifle and 25 magazines of .223 caliber ammunition, which meant each of them had 500 rounds. Each soldier had 28 grenades of various types, 14 regular grenades, 10 frag grenades, 2 white phosphorus grenades, an incendiary weapon meant to ignite cloth, fuel, ammunition, and more, and 2 smoke grenades. Rescue gear consisted of a signal mirror, a compass, and a bright red emergency panel. In his left pocket, Waugh carried hard candy for energy. As they moved along the riverbank, Billy Waugh began to worry about the communications gear. If the operation went bad and they needed air support, the radio was their lifeline. It had been decided early on that the PRC-25 FM radio was to be carried by one of the 86 Indige, but now Waugh was having second thoughts. Most of the Indige were poor farmers, he says. Now they were mercenaries, paid to fight someone else's war. This was the first time any of them had been in combat. Waugh had trained the group in small arms and unconventional warfare techniques, just as he'd trained hundreds of others like them, and he knew that the Indige might not stick around once shots started firing. On the other hand, he thought, there was nothing quite like a quick, successful ambush to bolster the confidence and competence of a mercenary. Either way, there was no guarantee. By nightfall, all but 15 of the Indige would be dead or gone. Approaching the camp, the group divided into 4 units, each with a Green Beret or CIA officer in the lead. A few hundred meters outside the target, Waugh suddenly found himself just feet away from a man and a woman hunched over. By the time they looked up at him, Waugh had his weapon on them. They were NVA cooks, collecting firewood, hard at work in these pre-dawn hours, preparing breakfast for soldiers who'd soon be awake. Behind a fence, Waugh spotted pots of food cooking over an open fire pit. As the man reached for the pistol on his hip, Waugh took a swift step forward, grabbed him around the shoulders, and pushed his knife into the man's throat. The woman came at him with a stick, striking him and making noise. Waugh slit her throat and set her body down on the jungle floor. all was quiet again. He knew instantly that the pace of the raid had to quicken. The noise could have alerted a sentry. Soon, all hell could break loose. He passed word down the line. From here on out, the men would communicate using hand and arm signals, no sound. Rounding a bend, Waugh caught sight of the enemy camp. The bamboo hooches, or sleeping barracks, were wide and low, with ceilings no more than 3 feet tall. Each hut was roughly 40 feet wide and lined with platforms, three soldiers to a bed. Doing the math quickly in his head, he figured there were 250 men here. He gave the signal to attack. The CIDG soldiers raised their M16s and opened fire. The gunfire led to chaos and pandemonium, with empty magazines dropping to the jungle floor. As the NVA soldiers leapt up from sleeping, a relentless barrage of firepower cut them down. Next, Waugh and the others began hurling grenades, observing dispassionately as men and their barracks caught on fire. Waugh recalls watching enemy soldiers drop to the ground and roll, trying to stop from being burned alive. Some fighters returned fire, but mostly they fled. Then, suddenly, unexpectedly, it got quiet. The battle was over. Waugh estimated that 150 NVA were dead. The rest appeared to have run off into the jungle. "For about 15 minutes, we congratulated each other," remembers Waugh. "We were celebrating, patting ourselves on the back, examining the Russian weapons left behind when they fled." Waugh remembers thinking how satisfying it was that the raid had been a success. But war is nothing if not full of surprises. From deep inside the jungle, there was a sharp, distinct sound, a bugle call, unmistakably a military command. Bugles meant soldiers, explains Waugh, NVA regulars. The NVA had called in the infantry using a signal instrument favored by American soldiers during the Revolutionary War. What none of them had realized was that the three sleeping hooches they'd just ambushed were the first three of several dozen hooches stretching deep into the jungle. Each held roughly 60 enemy soldiers. The Defense Department later estimated that there had been as many as 3,000 soldiers at Bong Song. The bugle call had just woken them all up. Waugh ran into the jungle, firing at anything that moved. He threw hand grenades and let off two flares, signaling to the team to disperse and retreat. The sound of boots was everywhere around him, the clattering of men. Commands yelled in Vietnamese. There was heavy gunfire coming at him and the green tracers of RPGs. The North Vietnamese Army had begun a massive counterattack, and Waugh was running out of ammo fast. Racing through the jungle, he headed toward the rally point, an old cemetery on the high ground, 650 feet to the west. Moving as fast as his legs could carry him, he suddenly found himself in an impossible situation. Directly in front of him, there was nothing but a wide-open rice paddy field. He'd run out of jungle, his only means of defense. Behind him was a battalion of battle-ready NVA. He had nowhere to go but across the open field. He ran fast, his jungle boots sloshing through the wet grass, concentrating hard on how to make it to the cemetery. There was commo hidden there, and commo meant an ability to call in airstrikes. Rounds from AK-47s buzzed past his head. He was now out of ammunition and grenades. He saw a green tracer from an RPG headed his way. Before he could react, bam, the RPG hit him in the right knee. The impact knocked him over. He lay face down in the wet grass. He pulled himself up on all fours and began to crawl. Finally, he spotted an embankment, a dirt irrigation berm running along the edge of the rice paddy. Concealed for the moment, he looked around to assess who was where. Sergeant Robert Brown, the young medic from Montana, had taken a bullet to the head and lay bleeding out in the grass. He counted 25, maybe 30, mercenaries dead in the open field, cut down by NVA firepower as they tried to escape. Waugh kept crawling. After another 100 or so feet, he came upon a hole in front of him as if someone had dug a pit. A foxhole in a rice paddy? How strange. He pulled himself down into the darkness. It was wet inside, about 4 feet wide. He couldn't determine how long. As he dragged himself down, he felt a flash of relief. He'd managed to escape from the enemy. He could hide here. Then he realized that there was someone or something down here in the hole with him. He couldn't see much in the dark. He heard breathing. He moved down the hole a little further until he was staring into the flaring nostrils of a water buffalo. He could make out the animal's sharp horns and its dark black skin. There were whiskers on its nose. The animal jerked its head and snorted as if to charge. Waugh wondered if he might die here, eviscerated by a water buffalo. But the animal was stuck in the mud, just as he was. Waugh might have laughed, except that he was soaking wet, bleeding heavily, and possibly losing consciousness. He could feel leeches crawling into his open wounds, eating their way into the space that used to be his right knee. Outside on the field, he heard enemy machine gun fire. His brain struggled to figure out a next move when suddenly David Morgan, the CIA operator, appeared alongside him in the hole. Morgan looked at the water buffalo, then at Waugh. The NVA knew they were in this hole, Morgan said. They had to move out. But Waugh was unable to move, and Morgan couldn't carry him. Waugh told Morgan to try to get to the cemetery alone. From there, he could call in airstrikes to lay down suppressive fire and force the NVA to disperse. Waugh could still get out of here on his own. David Morgan took off running. Waugh pulled himself up out of the hole and started crawling across the field. He made it about 10 feet when he was hit again, this time worse than before. The round smashed into the bottom of his foot, tearing through his boot and ripping apart his toes before exiting his body just above the ankle bone. He knew enough about the body to know that this most likely meant his military career was over. Face down in the mud, he strained to breathe. Tracers hit the dirt around him. He figured the enemy was 150 feet away. He needed to keep going, keep crawling, despite the pain. His right leg wasn't working. He looked down and saw exposed bone. "My foot had been almost entirely torn off," Waugh recalled. "There were leeches covering the wound, and I could see my exposed foot and ankle bones, white as snow." "Keep going," he told himself. "Stop and you're dead." When he took a shot to the left wrist, part of his brain tried having a conversation with him about what it would be like if he lost his leg and never walked on 2 feet again. Another part of his brain said, "Don't think about that," he recalls. The pain was intense, and he figured soon he'd lose consciousness. If the enemy got a hold of him, he was dead. Waugh reached into his rucksack. He pulled out his field syringe and morphine bottle, gave himself 3 quick shots. He waited for the drugs to take effect. A slight warm feeling came over him, but mostly he felt intense pain. Ahead, Waugh could see CIA operator David Morgan at the rallying point. He'd made it. Damn, this was a good sign, quickly followed by a bad one. David Morgan's hand signals indicated that the radio had been shot to pieces. There was no way to call for rescue or airstrikes. Waugh looked up. My God, he thought, was he hallucinating? Was this really Captain Paris D. Davis coming to get him? Waugh remembers staring into Davis's eyes and how incredibly blue they were. He normally didn't notice things like this, and it jerked him back into reality. Neither man had any way to radio for help. The situation was dire. They tried discussing what to do next. Davis had his right hand up, pointing at something when he got shot in the hand. The ends of his fingers were sheared off. Wah watched blood spurt into the air between them. Davis howled and swore. He was right-handed, he said. Now he couldn't even shoot. No commo, no ammo, thought Wah. No way to communicate, no ability to shoot. Their only hope was rescue. The sun was coming up. Wah pulled out his emergency panel and signal mirror. Davis made a run for the cemetery. An aircraft flying overhead, searching for the team, spotted what was happening and notified headquarters. The full fighting force of the U.S. Army and the Air Force was now coming to the rescue. It wasn't over yet. Lying helpless in the rice paddy, Wah looked up and watched the sky. He saw Navy F-8s and U.S. Air Force F-4C Phantom jets come in fast and low, dropping bombs and napalm on the battlefield. For a moment, he had hope. Then, suddenly, he took a bullet to the right side of his head. Most likely a ricochet, it sliced a 2-inch section of skin and bone off his forehead. The wound was not deep enough to kill him, but it was enough to knock him unconscious. When Wah awoke, the sun was high in the sky. Hours had passed, and he was baked in a thick mud shell like a crust. Warm rays beat down on him, and he looked at his watch to see what time it was. No watch. He was naked. The NVA must have mistaken him for dead, stripped him naked and taken his watch. After a few minutes, he heard the sounds of a helicopter. He couldn't believe he was alive. Thwap, thwap, thwap went the rotor blades. He watched as the helicopter landed. Out leapt a Special Forces soldier he knew, Sergeant First Class John Reinberg, a weapons expert. Was Reinberg really running toward him? He was pretty sure it was Reinberg, running in his jungle fatigues, crossing some 250 feet of open terrain. Or maybe the situation wasn't real. Maybe Wah was imagining things. Now, Reinberg was standing over him, talking. He told Wah he was here to get him out of this mess alive. In the distance, Wah eyed the helicopter that Reinberg said was going to medevac him to a MASH hospital not far away. It was a UH-1D. He could see people climbing inside. Reinberg told Wah he was going to carry him the 250 feet across the open field to the helicopters because Wah's right knee and left leg were useless. The blood had dried, but the bones were exposed and there were leeches eating at his flesh. Reinberg hoisted Wah up from behind, holding him under his armpits, dragging him toward the helicopter. Across the field, he spotted Paris Davis, alive, crawling toward the helicopter. Then he heard the terrible sound of RPG tracers all over again. "We're gonna make it," Reinberg promised as he dragged Wah across the rice paddy. "We're gonna make it." He lugged Wah's body 5 or 6 feet at a time. And just when Wah started to believe he might come out of this disaster alive, Reinberg took a bullet to the chest. "The bullet hit him just above the heart," remembers Wah. "And as he started to fall, a second bullet impacted his body, this time 6 inches lower down." Reinberg's lung collapsed and he struggled to breathe. In that instant, Reinberg went from being strong and heroic to being in worse shape than me. Another Green Beret came rushing out of the helicopter and began running across the open field. He was young. He grabbed Reinberg and started dragging him toward the helicopter. Maybe someone grabbed Billy Wah, or maybe he and Paris Davis continued crawling toward the helicopter. Later, in debriefs, neither man could clearly recall. Special Forces training teaches its soldiers what needs to be done to stay alive. Crawl, stay low, get to the helicopter no matter what. Now, the helicopter was just a few yards away. Waugh could see David Morgan and a few of the mercenaries waiting inside. The helicopter door gunner was laying down suppressive fire, trying to keep Waugh and Davis from being fired upon by NVA soldiers hiding in the trees. Waugh was inside the helicopter now. As the aircraft started to lift up off the ground, a green tracer flew into the cabin and hit the door gunner, shearing off part of his arm. Waugh watched the gunner stare at what remained of his limb as the helicopter took off and they flew away. When Billy Waugh awoke, he heard screaming. He was in a field hospital a few kilometers from Bong Song. Beside him in the next bed over, John Reinberg was howling in pain as the nurses worked to debride him, removing damaged tissue and foreign objects, dirt, debris, and insects from his gaping chest wounds. Waugh realized he was screaming too, and that the nurses were doing the same thing to his leg. A few days later, General William Westmoreland, commander of all U.S. forces in Vietnam, stopped by the field hospital and pinned a Purple Heart on Billy Waugh's uniform. Reinberg was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. Then came a U.S. Army doctor with grim news. Waugh was being sent back to the United States, to the lower extremity amputation ward at Walter Reed.